The storm that lashed Cape Cod that night, February 18, 1952, was one of the wildest in years. Off the Cape Cod coast, two tankers were fighting their way through mountainous waves whipped by gale winds. One was the 504-foot Pendleton, an oil tanker out of Baton Rouge, Louisiana. The other, the Fort Mercer. But the tankers were waging a losing battle. Messages clacked into Coast Guard stations along the coast and told the grim, spine-chilling story that the Fort Mercer had split into two. Immediately, Coast Guards went into action to attempt the rescue, but the odds against them were almost prohibitive. The messages continued to come into Chatham Coast Guard Station, where among those on duty was Boatswain's Mate First Class Bernard Weber, whose heroic actions during what later was described as one of the greatest marine disasters in almost a decade will forever be recorded as one of the finest chapters in Coast Guard history. Mr. Weber commanded a 36-foot motor lifeboat. He strapped himself to the wheel of the lifeboat and twice navigated the craft through the mountainous seas to the stern end of the other tanker, the Pendleton, which had broken in half off Chatham, and he rescued 32 seamen. For his heroism, Mr. Weber was awarded the Treasury Department's Gold Life-Saving Medal, the American Legion's Medal of Valor for heroism, and he was honored as the hero of 1952 by the Baltimore American Legion Post. WOCB News Headliners Today swings its spotlight to Bernard Weber, who will be interviewed by Wes Didstone of WOCB, Gordon Caldwell of the Cape Cod Standard Times, and this newsman, Ed Semprini. Would you care to relate for our audience the events of that day and night that led up to this rescue on February 18, 1952?
Well, as I recall, that particular day was full of events. We had a severe northeast snowstorm blowing. Several of the local boats in Chatham Harbor had broken their moorings and gone adrift on North Beach. We were very busy in the early part of the day, pulling these boats off the beach, bringing them back to their moorings, helping out the local fishermen. And we'd just come back into the Chatham Fish Pier, and one of the Coast Guard trucks came down the road, and man jumped out and said, "Get back to the station right away. There's a shipwreck offshore and they need help." So we piled in the truck, went back to the station, and Boatswain Clough, who was the officer in charge of the station at the time, said to get the duck and the breeches buoy and head down for Orleans and Nauset Beach. There's a wreck down there. A ship is broken in two. So without any further ado, we proceeded through the snow and had quite a time getting down to Orleans. And I recall as we got to the top of the hill there, the Orleans Beach parking lot, that the seas were running right over the beach, up the parking lot, and halfway up that hill. And the snow abated for a couple of minutes there, and we looked offshore and could see this gray-type hulk. And it was rolling along, pitching along, and moving up the beach. We're realizing that it was getting away from us fast and that we were helpless with the amphibian duck and beach apparatus. We proceeded back to Chatham. Upon arrival there, Boatswain Clough said to me, he says, "Get the lifeboat, get the crew, and go out and see what you can do." Well, as I recall, my heart sunk down to my feet because I realized the sea conditions. I was thoroughly familiar with Chatham Bar, and I was already bitter cold, and all the other Coast Guardsmen there were too. So I asked, I said, "Well, who will go? Who will go with me?"
You were asking for volunteers?
Well, in the Coast Guard, there's one of two ways. You may ask first, and if the response isn't immediate, you point your finger and say, "You, you, and you." But as it was, there were three fellas that volunteered to go. Richard Livesey, who I think at the present is stationed at Cape Cod Canal, a fellow by the name of Andrew Fitzgerald, who has since gotten out of the Coast Guard and lives in Whitingsville, Mass., and another fellow by the name of Irving Mask, who has since gotten out of the Coast Guard. By the way, Irving was a transit at Chatham Lifeboat Station. His actual duty station was on Stonehorse Lightship, but he'd gone home on leave and upon arrival back in Chatham had to remain at the station for transportation out to the lightship.
So you went aboard this 36-foot motor lifeboat with these three other Coast Guardsmen whose names you just mentioned.
Yes. Well, that's right. We went down to the Chatham Fish Pier. We had to row out to the lifeboat and the dory, and we got aboard, and it was just getting dark. It was probably after 5 o'clock in the afternoon, as I recall. And we proceeded down Chatham Harbor, and there was all kinds of speculation among us. Naturally, we could see the seas breaking on North Beach, and Old Harbor in Chatham was quite rough compared to its normal state, and we were weighing the possibilities of how we were going to get out over Chatham Bar, and naturally, there was a lot of apprehension. So then somebody suggested singing, and we all started singing a song. I can't even recall what it is now, but down the harbor we went, singing away and trying to understand what our fate was to be. Well, I recall getting at the end of Chatham Harbor and looking out over the bar, and the seas coming in there were mountains, and the boat seemed smaller than ever to me at that moment. I think there was a time and perhaps a little panic set in, and I said, well, can I turn back? Shall I go ahead? What's to be done? And then in my mind, I call it the workings of God, because you receive the strength and the courage, and you know what your duty is, so you realize you have to attempt. It's born in you. It's part of your job, so we started out over the bar, and I remember the first sea that hit us came down with a tremendous crash, and next thing the compass was gone and the windshield was broken and we had glass in our faces and in our hair and so forth, and it was quite dark by this time. And I remember asking Andy Fitzgerald if he would go forward and turn on the spotlight and just shine it out over the bow so I could get a glimpse of the sea coming at us, or possibly be able to see a buoy. And Andy did. He went forward. And he turned the light on. And the next thing I know, a tremendous sea hit us. The searchlight went up in the air. And the last I recall, I saw Andy Fitzgerald just going up in the air, legs and arms. And he disappeared. And my heart went down to my feet. I said, my God, I've lost Andy. He's been washed overboard. Another sea hit us, and a tremendous thump came behind me. And I looked, and here was Andy Fitzgerald laying on the deck down behind me. Evidently, he had been thrown out of the boat up into the air, and the next sea caught him and threw him back into the boat behind me. And Andy was to suffer a little bit more after that. Well, we proceeded out over the bar, and my feelings were I couldn't turn around. I really didn't know where I was. I had no compass, and aids to navigation are few and far in between there. So I felt that the best bet was for me to keep the boat headed into the sea and as we call it, jog. In other words, when you have heavy seas, you just kind of let the engine idle along and try to climb up the mountains. When the seas roll in on you, you give her the gun to give you the power to get through them, and when you get on the other side, you slack back so you can fall down into them again. So as it was, we got out over the bar. I knew this because there was a change in the type of sea we were running into. And it began the heavy swells with the break on top. So at that moment, I said, well, if I continue to head into the sea, I'm going to go offshore. Possibly I may find Pollock Rip Lightship. The wreck, I didn't know where it was. The radio was so tied up with traffic I couldn't get the station. We were really on our own. So as we proceeded along under these conditions, all of a sudden I had a strange feeling come over me. I said, there's something there. I felt that it was like a stone wall or something. So I asked Andy once again if he'd go forward and put that searchlight on, which he did, and all of a sudden, looming right in front of us, if I had gone another 50 feet, I'd have run right into it, was this hulk. There were no lights on this particular side of it. It was just the hulk, and she was rolling around and pitching up and down. I says, my gosh, here's a wreck, and there's nobody aboard. So I started to circle it with the light on it. We went around, and I came to the gaping hole where it had split in half, and you could have driven trucks through these holes. It's a tremendous ship, tremendous compartments in it, and all ripped and torn. Well, oddly enough, when I got on the other side, it was lit up, and I realized then that there must be life aboard. The generators must be running. The sea had been hitting it, and evidently had broken everything, so that that was the reason for the darkness. So we pulled up alongside of it as best we could, and I looked up, and there was one man. It almost seemed like a storybook type of thing. He looked very small, about a half an inch tall. It was up so high. And he was waving his arms. Then he disappeared. The next thing I knew, out came the men, and they lined the rails, and they were in these orange life jackets, and they're all waving frantically. And I says, my God, what are we going to do? I said, where am I going to put these men? How am I going to get them off? All these different things passed through my mind. I said, if I fail, what a tragic thing. How can you ever live it down if all these people get killed? The responsibility, you feel it. It's on your mind, and with the facilities you have, you say, just how are you going to do the job? There again, the workings of God comes in. These men threw what we call a Jacob's ladder, which is a rope ladder, over the side of the ship, and they began coming down the ladder one at a time. And to get each man off, I'd have to make 2-3 passes, and I was so afraid that the boat would become smashed up against the hull and that we'd go down and the men wouldn't be able to get off, one thing or another. All these things passed through your mind. Well, the first few men to come down were lucky. They jumped. The ladder was short, by the way, so that sometimes when they'd jump, it would be several feet because the ship would roll over on its side and it'd make the ladder higher out of the water. And the next minute it would roll back towards you and put the ladder underwater. So it was a precarious situation. But the first few men jumped and landed aboard the boat in various conditions. A few of them were hurt. They landed in various places. And I'll never forget my boys, the crewmen I had. They scrambled around that boat, not thinking of themselves or anything else, and went after these men and herded them inside. And then the next two or three came down the ladder, and as it was, they missed the boat and went into the water, and we had to round them up, get them out of the water. And this was precarious. It was difficult, but we were lucky. We got them back. And after the first 15 or 20 of these men, I began to realize my main problem. My boat was getting overloaded, was getting very crowded. I had the forward compartment chock full. And I said, where am I going to put the rest of them? Well, we just had to make space. And as they came down, the boys just shoved them in that forward compartment, just jammed them in there like sardines in a can. And then they began piling them behind me in the coxswain's flat. Next thing I knew, a sea came up behind us and picked the boat and just threw it right into that propeller. And all I could do was back the boat and back the engine, get out of there. And at this point, I did so violently. I backed the boat so violently that the engine quit. And I tried starting it from the coxswain flat position. It just wouldn't start. So I sent Andy Fitzgerald, who was the engineer, down into the engine room and asked him to try and get the engine going, Andy, which he did. Next thing I heard ungodly screaming coming out of the engine room. I said, my God, what has happened? The same moment the engine started. And I heard this terrible screaming. The boat took a sudden lurch, and the screaming stopped. And out came Andy Fitzgerald, crawling out of the engine room. And I hollered at him, asked him what had happened. Well, the situation was that Andy had gone down into that engine room. It was a gasoline engine. And you had four spark plugs to each cylinder, or each part of the engine. There was some 16 or 18 spark plugs there, and Andy somehow or other had wound up right on the top of the heads of that engine when it started. And it burnt his back terribly. He had welts right down the whole length of his back from these spark plugs, the ignition of the spark plugs. So Andy came out, and good-natured that he was, he just said that, you know, he'd been shocked, and he wound up on top of the engine. Well, at that point, another tremendous sea hit us and evidently hit the Pendleton. I remember seeing the lights. The ship rolled right down towards us, and it seemed like the lights came right into my face. They were so close. So evidently, the ship took a very heavy roll, and then it rolled back, and it just disappeared from us. This all happened in an instant. So then, with the 32 survivors aboard, plus the four of us, a very heavily laden boat, I said, what am I to do next? I knew that I couldn't stay out to sea. I didn't know where any of the larger Coast Guard ships were. I knew there was some way offshore on the Fort Mercer. I didn't know where Pollock was. I had no compass to determine how to get back to shore, so that all I could do was think of a little bit of logic, and I assumed, I said, if I put the sea behind me and just jog along, that I'll land up on the beach at Cape Cod somewhere. So I passed the word to the crewmen, to the survivors, that if the boat all of a sudden stopped, or hit the beach, not to waste any time, ask any questions, to get off and help those that were hurt, help them off, and just get off as fast as you could. And I felt that if I had put the boat bow onto the beach and kept the engine going ahead fast, we might have those few instants you'd need to get the men off. So we proceeded along. I just letting the sea kind of push me along, hoping for the snow to clear, hoping to be able to see something somewhere that I'd recognize and be able to get a bearing from. The first thing I recall was a little red light flashing. And at first I said, well, what could that be? I said, can it be the radio towers at Chatham? Could it be a buoy? What could it be? 1,000 red lights went through my mind at the time, and not knowing where I was, I could think of it as being almost anything. At one minute, it seemed like it'd be way up over our heads, and the next minute, it seemed like it'd be down underneath the boat. So we proceeded along, and as it was, I bumped into that red light. And oddly enough, that was the buoy on the inside of Chatham Bar. And we had come back in, come over the bar, and had wound up inside, and I couldn't have been any more on course than if I had planned it. So there again, the workings of God. And the rest is a simple story of back to the Chatham Fish Pier, and then with the help of the wonderful people in the town of Chatham and the many departments, the survivors were well taken care of, and that's about it.